Hello, everyone. My name is Raj Mehta, and welcome back to Richard Lehman Discusses EBM. How are you today, Richard?
I've got a slight cold, so I might cough a little bit and sound a bit snotty, but otherwise, I think we should proceed and see how we get
Well, we're all hoping you get better soon, Richard. I'm
on.
looking forward to today because I think today is going to be a really fun topic for us to discuss, and one we skirted around the edges of in the past, but we're going to try our best to tackle it wholeheartedly today.
Well, you think it's fun. The fun's gone out of screening for me. It's a topic that I've lived with for a long time, and it's merged into a fog of overdiagnosis and skepticism on my part. So perhaps we can start with a few positive observations from you, Raj.
Well, I'm really excited to have this discussion with you because I trained in the early and mid 2000s. And of course, population health was an important part of how I was trained as a physician. And that included screening for chronic diseases, screening for cancers. And it seemed at that time when I was training that the idea of preventative medicine was really key to transforming how we took care of patients. Because, of course, if you can prevent an illness, it's far better than trying to treat or reverse it after it's already happened. As I've gone further past my training and as a faculty member, I've realized that this has been a tricky business because, unfortunately, the screening is often not as good as we would hope. And the challenge and this dichotomy between public health and the health we provide as clinicians and primary care doctors in the office sometimes conflicts a little bit. There's a little bit of nuance to that as well. And it's now brought me to this point where I want to dive back and learn the history of how we got to this point where we're having all these screening tests that we do so often, where the philosophy and the ideals of population health really first came from. And if this was the goals that its original founders had where we're at, and what are things we can maybe look forward to going forward?
Yeah, well, you've said three things that I don't particularly agree with there.
Oh, great. Let's hear it.
First of all, screening is not prevention. Screening is detection. Secondly, prevention is not always better than a cure. And thirdly, I'm not sure this belongs in the domain of private primary care. As I understand it, but then my understanding of primary care is very much that we take care of ill people and leave the rest to others who are better at it, including preventive medicine, which I'm not dismissing altogether. I'm just saying those things to raise a few very basic issues which arise when we talk about screening and then confuse it with prevention.
Yes, this is a very important point. So, do you want to begin by discussing those points, or do you want to dive a little bit into the history, Richard?
Well, I could do a little bit of both. The history is fairly simple in that Dr. Papanicolaou discovered in the 1920s, as early as that, that you could pick up cancerous cells on the female cervix, and that would allow you to diagnose actual cervical cancer. I'll call it cervical because I prefer that to the English pronunciation, which is cervical. But in that apart, he then discovered that you could pick up so-called precancerous cells from the cervix. And this became well established as a way of avoiding full-blown cervical cancer in research done in the 1940s. So this has been around for a very long time and established what seemed like a very exciting principle that you could detect certain diseases at an early enough stage and that you knew enough about the life cycle of the disease, the progression of the disease, and you had enough time and you had an effective treatment. And the big step forward then came when Wilson set down criteria for screening in general, because people were then trying to screen for lung cancer and for urinary infection and renal disease, and the results were very mixed. So Wilson and Junger then set out to draw an intellectual map, as it were, of what would work and what you need of a condition in order to be able to screen effectively for it. I won't go through all 10 principles. We'll perhaps discuss them as we go along. But basically, I've already mentioned some of them. That there should be a recognizable latent or early symptomatic stage, and that there should be a suitable test or examination. And then there should be some acceptable treatment that patients would actually want to undergo, and the test also needed to be one that patients wanted to undergo. So that, in a nutshell, is the history of screening up to the 1970s. And I'll stop at that point, just allow you to make a few observations on how it's gone since.
Well, that's a great review. And some of those history is a great reminder of things I didn't know as well. And it's really interesting to hear that history of the initial success with cervical cancer screening, because I feel like that is kind of the original hope or paradigm that we kind of try to replicate with other forms of similar screening. And this initial intellectual goal of trying to consolidate and set standards for how screening should go about with chronic diseases, because they can get very messy. And it's nice to know that you want to have consistency along disease spectrums, along patient expectations, something that has some utility. And my understanding of the history is in the 1970s, you start having more population math come into the fore. And this was a little bit of a change, because up till then, your math was kind of focused on the individual patient. So perhaps for this patient, if you were able to diagnose a disease early on in its early phase or latent phase and treat it, there was a clear benefit to that one person. When you start doing population health math, it's a little bit different, because now you can say, oh, if we're going to look at 1,000 people, then we can perhaps help 10 of them. We can shift the curve of the whole population and prevent, you know, 1% or 2% of a chronic disease in a population. And then the effect size is smaller. So for the individual, you may not necessarily do that, but now you can justify it on this population scale. And that opens the door perhaps to doing more than you would have before.
Yes, more and more. And more is always better. That's the problem with this paradigm of screening. The fact is that a lot of human disease regresses spontaneously. And so for the individual, it's a gamble that will probably never benefit them. And we've talked about this before in terms of treatment for risk factors. To some extent, screening goes into the kind of risk factor territory, if you think of blood pressure measurement as screening, or cholesterol measurement as screening, and so forth, and go outside the field of trying to detect precancerous lesions or cancerous lesions that are sufficiently early to be eliminated, such as lung nodules on CT scans of smokers. And that takes us also into the territory of which groups you screen. So and the way that predictive values vary according to the groups that you choose to screen. So those are all topics we'll need to cover if we're going to do any justice to this topic. I think your mind is probably much better prepared for this than mine, because I stopped teaching undergraduate students about this stuff about 4 years ago, and you're still doing it. But I don't consider it really the mainstream territory of primary care, which is a difficult enough task in itself without involving us in population statistics, and that's the point that I was trying to make at the beginning. But I won't labour that one. Come back to the main stream now, please, Raj, and tell us what you think about where we've got to.
Well, I want to return to highlight the three points you said at the beginning of this chat, which was that screening is not prevention, prevention is not cure, and that perhaps prevention is not in the domain of what we're doing in the primary care office. So we want to keep those three thoughts in mind as we tackle each one of these topics. And we can begin with perhaps one of the most famous is blood pressure management, because you've mentioned this, but before we did a lot of population health, management of blood pressure is really based on those patients with the highest symptoms, severe comorbidities, and clear treatment goals. And then the moment we started looking at blood pressure as a population, our goal shifted and we started setting targets that were lower, treating patients who were asymptomatic, perhaps without comorbidities, in the hope of benefiting a full population. And so I imagine that was a shift in practice of how you manage blood pressures in the 70s and the 80s. I would say it is a net good, in my opinion, because of course, treating many people with asymptomatic blood pressure probably prevents a lot of diseases, but it does so on a population level. For each individual, that benefit is there, but it's of smaller magnitude, not always as obvious. And what do we do when we screen for blood pressure? Does screening for it meaning we can cure it? And is this something that should be in the domain of primary care?
Well, are you asking me to answer those questions? Because I think here we've discussed this before. I don't want to go too much over ground we've done before, but if we look at Wilson's criteria now, it should be an important health problem. Well, it is on a population level. But for the individual patient having a blood pressure of, say, 145 over 95 is unlikely to make a great deal of difference and certainly won't cause them symptoms, but does put them into a slightly higher risk group than someone with a blood pressure 10 millimeters mercury lower in both respects. So then that we come on to the next Wilson criterion, which is that natural history of the condition, including the development from latent to declared disease, should be adequately understood. Well, we do understand it in relation to blood pressure, but only as a statistical risk. And so I think Wilson was thinking more there in terms of a natural history of a cancer or something like that. And then there should be a suitable test or examination, which of course we have for blood pressure, but we don't know which one is the best. We're still debating amongst ourselves as to whether the home measurements versus office measurements and which particular device we use to measure blood pressure should be used. And the test is acceptable to the population, yes. And there should be an agreed policy, he says, on whom to treat as patients. Now, there we have a difficulty in the Wilson criteria because we all argue between ourselves as to what the threshold should be. There should be an accepted treatment for patients with a recognized disease. Yes, fortunately, as we said in a previous episode, we now have almost too many acceptable treatments. We don't know in which order to use them and which have indeed the best very long-term results. And then there are arguments about the time and opportunity costs of treatments. And so Wilson had worked out all these things before the current climate of try and test for everything. And as a result, he set a group of us who are skeptics about overdiagnosing versus another group who are enthusiasts for all forms of early diagnosis. And this has been a subject of many of our discussions together. And so we're back in territory we've been to before.
I think this is good, and I'm going to offer a slight counterpoint. I think blood pressure is a good example of Wilson's criteria. I think the reason we've done this is because we've kind of cheated and made it conditional. We're no longer saying just blood pressure. We're saying blood pressure in someone with diabetes, blood pressure in someone who has already heart disease, blood pressure in someone who's older and genetic risks, blood pressure in someone who has no risks and is a young person. And so we've kind of broken it up conditionally into actually several different things. And then we say, oh, if you have blood pressure with diabetes, this is going to be our threshold. And we have these treatments, and we have data suggesting in diabetics with blood pressure, these medicines are better. And or in just an asymptomatic person, we can say, maybe this is a good time to try and lose some weight and diet and exercise and cut back on drinking a little bit of wine. So I feel we've become a little bit more nuanced, and I feel blood pressure perhaps is a good example where we have to take on additional information. It gives us an opportunity to be collaborative with patients and individualize it, but that we've turned this into something which was perhaps initially just too generic, too population level, and now we have ability to individualize it a little bit more, and I think that makes it useful. And to me, I want to contrast this with the next thing to talk about, which you had brought up, was lung nodules, because lung nodules, if I think about this and I think about Wilson's criteria, here's something that certainly we're concerned, because the natural history of a lung nodule is that it could eventually advance and turn into a lung cancer, but it could also very easily regress and go away, or it may not be cancerous at all. It may just be an incidental finding that doesn't change at all over time. And the tests to evaluate this are CT scans, which have a risk of radiation and takes time and is very costly. And what do you do as you're monitoring this? Well, if it gets bigger, the next step is an invasive procedure to try and biopsy it, which is not at all comfortable. And many of those come back showing that, in fact, it's benign. And so it's not immediately obvious. And there's no easy way to individualize it. I mean, if someone has a history of smoking or maybe exposure to asbestos, I can say you're a higher risk. But for most people, it's much harder because they don't have that. And I can't really individualize what I'm doing. And I'm really worried about overdiagnosis in this situation.
Yep, that was exactly the counterexample that I was going to go on to.
Oh, I beat you to
And
the
then
punch, Richard.
there's a lot of in-between stuff too, isn't there? Colonoscopy screening and so on. We could go into detail about different examples. I think they all illustrate the point that there isn't a clear area where we can tell individual patients exactly what to do. And one of the problems with screening programs is that they tend to be imposed on whole populations. And whole populations can't decide as an en masse as to whether they agree with these. They're always politicized into being a good thing. And a classic example, of course, is screening mammography in different countries. You in the States probably do more mammograms at more ages than any other country, whereas Switzerland, which is one of the few countries richer than America, actually doesn't has stopped advising screening mammography altogether. So you've got a tremendous difference there in attitude by those in charge. And I don't know enough detail to discuss that in detail, but it does raise this question of how you define the benefits of screening and how you stop people thinking if there's a screening test, let everybody have it because one life lost is too many. What are your arguments against that?
It's very tricky, and you're right that to some degree politics become part of this, and it becomes political perhaps because our hopes don't always align with the reality of what these screening tests can do. So mammography and breast cancer, it's a horrible way to have to deal with death. And any tool that might help us to presumably diagnose breast cancer early enough to treat and prevent a breast cancer death seems like a remarkable and really important things to do. And certainly there's a lot of promotion and a lot of advocacy to value that. The challenge is that the data of mammography is very mixed. And part of this, if we go back to Wilson's criteria, begins with the natural history of how breast cancer works, because with cervical cancer, you have these early stages of precancerous lesions and many years before it devolves into cervical cancer. And if you catch it early enough, you can prevent that spread. Breast cancer is often far more aggressive. Many times, by the time it's detectable in the breast, it's often metastasized already microscopically elsewhere. And the natural history doesn't obviously lend itself to the same screening paradigm as you might have with other cancers. And then in addition to that, the data is very tricky because there isn't really good data that it has any reduction in all-cause mortality. Yes, there is a small reduction in breast cancer-related mortality. Again, a very, very small magnitude effect, really not as good as one would hope. And so when you have small magnitude effects on outcomes that are disease-dependent, deaths are difficult labels. They're not as clear-cut as clear mortality because it depends on how you define and how you label, et cetera. It's not surprising that different individuals reviewing this data might come to different conclusions about what's the best way to approach it. And then different countries have different epidemiology. They have different rates of disease onset. And so that baseline rate of cancer incidence changes what you might recommend. It's just very, very challenging. And then you add on to that, what is the implementation of it? It's one thing to say, okay, we can offer this to everybody. But then when you have metrics and pay for performance coming into it, suddenly you're putting physicians in a position where you're saying, well, here's breast mammogram. We want you to make sure you get 80% of your patients' screening done to hit the metrics for good quality of care. And that's tough because then it makes care decision-making harder. And sometimes it biases to do more rather than having those conversations about what the patient may want.
Yeah. And I don't think you can have a long enough conversation with patients. Paul Grashu did a study in Australia as to how a citizen's jury of men might decide on whether to have a PSA test for cancer screening. And he prepared an awful lot of illustrative material. All the men came along saying, yeah, of course we'd have it. We don't want to have cancer of the prostate. And then they went through a day of being taught about the basic principles of screening and the possible side effects of intervention, including impotence and incontinence and so on. And the fact that the mortality difference at the end seemed very small indeed. And it took 2 days for them really to agree, most of them within themselves and as a group, on whether they'd have it or not. And we don't have 2 days with every patient to describe.
That's right.
We're as you say, we're incentivized to make an offer. And if we make an offer, we're already in nudging patients in the direction of an intervention. So it becomes an extraordinarily difficult thing, which is why I think it should be taken out of the realm of individual conversations between primary care doctors and their patients, because we have an awful lot of other things to do. And I don't think we can do this particular task very well.
This is a great point. And it's like, is this the domain of primary care? Because in your 10 or 15 minute or perhaps 30 minutes, how can you get through all this and how do you explain it? And to some degree, public health is in the realm of like advocacy and public health campaigns and commercials and advertisement and discussing with patients. And how well a job do we do encouraging this with balanced information and shared decision making? You know, the campaigns are go do this intervention, not this is important for you to know about the pros and cons of this information. Be educated about your choice. You know, so it's, you know, it's hard because like when you don't offer that balanced information of choice in your public campaign, you're thrusting more and more in the domain of the primary care office. And I'm not sure it should solely be there.
Yeah. Well, I sent you an article this afternoon. I don't know if you Yes. had time to read it. It's one that really influenced me in 1990, which was 33 years ago, and I was on the threshold of becoming middle-aged. And I had so far rather resisted getting too academic about medicine. Reading this, it struck me that, you know, these Wilson criteria were so well thought through. And this article, for the first time, presented to me a ROC curve, which I'd never seen before. It talked in terms of sensitivity and specificity, which I had heard of, but kept forgetting the actual meaning of.
I'm glad we're not the only one.
Yeah, quite. And so it got me talking to the authors and eventually becoming a member of their department. And it did, even then, it showed that the pap smear, for instance, produces an enormous number of investigations, colposcopies, follow-up smears, and so forth. In the end, it cost in those days 130,000, let's say probably now £1 million, to save a single life from cancer of the cervix, which is, of course, a horrible way to die, and particularly so in women of in the fullness of life. That raised these questions for me then. And now, of course, we have a further complication in that we know a lot more about the natural history of cervical cancer. We know that it's caused by certain papillomaviruses. We can actually test for the viruses themselves. We can immunize against the virus. And so the relative benefit of doing smears is now becoming less and less, and of course other forms of screening, such as for the virus, virus itself, have come into play. And so it's never a static situation. It always depends on the state of the art. And now, for instance, with prostate cancers, not just PSA, but you can do follow-up MRIs and biopsies in a much more sophisticated way than was possible when the main screening trials were done. So we have to be cognizant of that. But as GPs, I don't think actually we can be fully informed. And I think this is a challenge to evidence-based medicine, that we've got to have a way to communicate about these population issues, which doesn't depend on putting it on the shoulders of one particular individual talking to another particular individual. There has to be some form of educative process, which AI may help with, in order to pre-inform patients and allow better informed decisions about whether to undergo screening or not.
Well, I can't disagree with any of those things. I'm on the same page as you, Richard. And I want to add one more example on here, because I think this kind of shows this evolving change, as you point out, and the nuance that each one of these really gets into the intervention and the details of the disease epidemiology. And that's some of the variations in colon cancer screening. In the US, we probably do more colonoscopies for colon cancer screening than any other country. And in other places, I know in Canada and in large parts of Europe, you know, stool testing is far more common. And one of the reasons we highly recommend colonoscopies in addition to stool testing others, which is also acceptable, is because we believe in the US that we have high rates of colon cancer, and we believe that colonoscopies have a high rate of adenoma detection, and that can help not just catch it, but even prevent colon cancer. So the screening modality is preventative in the case of colonoscopy, because if you see a polyp and you clip it, and it turns out it was something precancerous, you've prevented that from growing out. Whereas if you're doing a stool test or things like that, you're just doing screening. There's nothing preventative there. And so having RCTs that really show the validity of this was important. And a major RCT came out last year that was done actually in Poland and in Scandinavian parts of Europe. And they found that colonoscopy didn't actually make much of a change in all-cause mortality. And that led to much discussion and questions on the value of colonoscopy. And there were differences because colon cancer rates were not as high in those countries. And many of the GI doctors in the States pointed out that their adenoma detection rate, which means how skilled they were at doing colonoscopies, was not as high as they were in the US. So it still felt in the US this might be beneficial. but just it just adds to the amount of nuance that's going here, that every place, every locality has to kind of consider these various factors. And it's not always obvious. And as the technology changes, if AI can help GI doctors in real time in colonoscopy have higher rates of adenoma detection, does colonoscopy end up becoming superior because of that? Or are we being overly optimistic here, perhaps being, you know, persuaded too much by disease-specific outcomes on something with minimal all-cause mortality effect? And should we be more cost-effective and conscientious like other countries are and just stick with stool screening first and then colonoscopy and so on?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very skeptical about stool screening. I've just called it smelly randomization because, you know, it's so blunt an instrument that you can't really identify.
Well, we do have now the DNA stool test, so that's meant to be a little bit better.
Yeah, now that's different, and of course, as it just reinforces the point we're both making, is that the technology makes a difference. So that if you write a booklet about screening for use by your patients, it's probably going to be out of date within a couple of years, and it'll always depend to some extent on the biases of the person writing it. To pass it on to AI in the future is all very well, but of course we're living in the present at the moment, and I think that is a big problem because we are in a transitional stage with a lot of this stuff. I think probably in 20 years' time, we'll have a much better idea of the natural history of a lot of diseases. We already know that breast cancer is not a single entity. It's probably at least 20 different entities. And if we were able to determine which of those it was by some form of early testing, we could stratify patients much, much better. So I think we're probably done with the main discussion here, Raj. I feel I've been a little bit, how shall I say, inarticulate and digressive on this. But I think that's the nature of the subject. So perhaps you could come up with a few clearer points to end our discussion.
Yeah, so screening is practically a real part of what we do in primary care. But there are challenges with it. First of all, there's a lot of misunderstanding about what screening does. And it's important, as Richard has done, to go and understand the history a little bit. Screening, as he points out, is not always preventative. And treating and curing diseases is different from screening. And there's a question of whether screening really even belongs in the domain of what we do in the primary care office. Nevertheless, it's there and it's part of what we do. Screening is hard to judge as a whole. There's criteria of when it's of value, and depending on the disease, the illness, the natural history, and the changing of technology, both for screening purposes and for treatments, changes how we might approach topic. So always there's a bit of evolution and thinking about it. I think there are good examples of screening done well, which are more modern day approaches to blood pressure and how it can be individualized and tailored. And there are forms of screening which are still very, very blunt, and the worries of overdiagnosis are ever present. And I think things with lung nodules are there. I think we have to be mindful in current environments where metrics can kind of depersonalize how we approach screening and just make it very easy to just promote doing things rather than having collaborative efforts with patients. But that's still fundamentally important. And I think we just have to be open-minded, engaging as these things constantly change with us in the future.
Thanks very much for that, Raj. I'm glad you mentioned the word overdiagnosis there. This is a topic that we could try and discuss in a future episode, but it's, again, one I'm slightly scared of because although I've been a member of an overdiagnosis group now for, I think, probably most of 10 years, I still can't come up with a good definition of what overdiagnosis is. And I think it's a very difficult concept to communicate with patients. We may think we understand it, but it's very difficult to unpersuade patients of the idea that everything that detects disease early is going to be good for them, because it might be very bad for them if they end up having some disastrous procedure for a lesion which doesn't actually matter anything to them. And this whole business of whole body screening and so on is something that's come and rather gone away as a result of that. Anyway, I'm rambling again, and I think we've had a nice little chat here, and I hope we can continue this topic another time. Thanks, Raj.
Wonderful. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.